bloody business.
Welcome to This Bloody Business. I'm your host, indie filmmaker Andrew Johnson Schmidt. Each episode, we talk to the creative people behind the movies that make us scream in terror and delight. From The Best Boy to The Final Girl, these are the people who bring our nightmares to life. Tonight's episode is the last of our three-part interview with Deep Cuts horror filmmaker Gary Sherman. This is the guy who made the last great practical effects film, Poltergeist 3. Tonight, Gary talks about working with legendary effects artist Dick Smith and those astonishing mirror shots, all done practical. How'd he do it? Listen and find out. Here's part three of my interview with Gary Sherman.
The ultimate skyscraper is having some problems.
We'll get those problems before they get us, right?
With its heating.
What are you about? You!
With its elevators. With its pool. Don't be alarmed. There's a logical explanation. Poltergeist 3, rated PG-13.
Yeah, well, Poltergeist 3 was a real deviation from everything else I've ever done. And I didn't want to do Poltergeist 3. I had no real want to do that movie. I just, Jay and Laddie called me. They were running MGM at the time. And, you know, Poltergeist 2 had been a great disappointment for the studio. And they said they wanted to do Poltergeist 3 and they needed something to kick the studio in the butt. And they had just been brought over from where they were before at Fox, and they had left Fox. And and they were hired to run MGM. And so they called me and they said, you want to do Poltergeist 3? And I said, no, thank you. And they said, no, we really want you to do it. And I said, no, thank you. And they just kept pushing me. And they, hey, we gave you Deadline. We know you all was. And so finally I said, well, I'll tell you what, here's the deal. I want to spend some time in Chicago. So if I can shoot it in Chicago and have the world's biggest haunted house, and they said, what would that be? I said, the John Hancock Building, because I love the John Hancock Building and always wanted to shoot something there. I said, I want to shoot it in Chicago in the John Hancock Building. I want to make the biggest haunted house that's ever existed. It's one of the biggest buildings in the world. And I want to shoot all the effects practical. And Laddie looks at me and says, are you out of your fucking mind? I said, well, you already know that. You've worked with me before. But he said, can you do that? And I said, you know I can do that. I mean, I've done it in Dead and Buried. All the effects are practical, and there's not, you know, there's a couple of dissolves in Dead and Buried, but that's about as close to, you know, any kind of mechanical effect or any kind of filmic effect that I've ever done. And obviously, Deathline, it's all practical. And I know it. I cut my teeth on that. And I said, you know, and I have a minor in optics from college, and I've never really gotten to use all of that stuff. I know reflection and refraction inside and out. And that's what I want to do. And I said, basically, I want to do Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass as Poltergeist. And it's all going to be mirrors. Smoke and mirrors. It's all really going to be smoke and mirrors. And Laddie said, okay, let's see what, write a script. Let's see what it'll be. And so that's what I did. And, you know, and he said, how much is this going to cost me? I said, it's going to cost you probably less than doing it CGI. And it's going to cut post-production to nothing. And you know how I shoot. So this way, if I'm not doing any CGI, I can really lay out the whole film, shoot only what needs to be shot, and do. So he said, okay. So I wrote the original script. And then I wrote an ending on that script that budgeted out to cost almost as much as the rest of the movie. Not really, but, and they just said to me, can we simplify the ending? And I said, well, you won't be happy if we do. So anyways,
What the ending would have been?
Well, the ending involved a lot of transitions. And one of them was Carol Ann morphing into Tangina and Tangina morphing into Carol Ann, which all would have been done by Dick Smith.
Wow.
And different ways of coming through the glass, which were really, I mean, we would have had to bring about 30 special effects people because we were shooting in Chicago, and there weren't enough special effects people in Chicago to do it. So we would have had to bring about 30 special effects people in to do the scene. And, it just would have, and Dick said it was going to take him about, you know, 3 or 4 months or whatever to perfect the prosthetics that he'd have to build in order to do it. Because again, I was going to do it all practice. I mean, you know, you could do it with CGI, but I didn't want to. And then you could morph, you know, but it looks like CGI.
Sure.
When you do it practical and you have people like Dick Smith or Stan Winston to help you do it practical, it looks real. And you go, oh my God, how did they do that? And or it actually looks so real you don't even have to ask how'd you do it. They just assume that you did it.
One of the things is like what you're talking about, when Carol Ann reaches at the glass in her bedroom, and the evil Carol Ann on the other side takes her hands and then drags her up the glass.
Right.
I remember when I looked at that just last night, I remember thinking if it was CGI, I'd be like, yeah, it's CGI. My mind would have checked out. But since I knew it was practical, my mind was scurrying, trying to figure out how the hell did they do that?
Well, how we did that was that the entire set of Carol Ann's bedroom, for lots of reasons, was 10 feet off the ground.
Ah.
Because a lot of stuff was being worked from underneath. Lots. And there were many effects. It also was a double set. The bedroom was mirrored on the other side. There was a mirror of the bedroom on the other side. And we could either have no glass, which, you know how you get refraction at the edge of a mirror? Well, we did the refraction with plastic tubing. So there was plastic tubing pulled from the floor to the ceiling, which looked like the edges of mirrors. It was really funny when we were doing that. People would walk, even though they didn't see their own reflection, nobody walked through. Everybody just assumed that it was glass or mirror. And it was really funny. And people on the set got so confused. And then we could replace those with real mirrors. So sometimes it was real mirror. Sometimes some of it was real mirror and some of it was open air. I know optics enough to know exactly where my depth of field was. So I could put a real mirror next to, if the camera was in a place that it was going to be reflected, I'd pull the mirror and just have the plastic tubes in there so that I could put the camera where it would be reflected in the mirror. But I could see through to the other set and then reflection of this set, which was absolutely perfectly the same. And I knew that the focal distance from the camera to the other set was exactly the same as the reflective image on this side of the set, because, you know, when you focus into a mirror, it's the distance from the camera to the mirror to the image that's reflected.
Yeah.
Is where you pull your focus to. You don't focus to the mirror, you focus to the image. So when I had a real mirror and no mirror, and it had a character on one side and a double on the other side, the focal length was exactly the same. So anyhow, we were 10 feet off the ground, and we had a mirror made that was like 23 feet high, and it was like really thick glass, and it was backed, and it was on a hydraulic lift, so that when the fingers, and we drilled the holes in the mirror, which you don't see because Carol Ann's hands are covering the holes, and then the other hands push through from the other side. And that was at the beginning. Then the mirror goes up. Carol Ann's hands were prosthetics that were actually attached to the mirror. And she slipped them in, and there was a rig that came down that held her arms. And then her belly, there was a hole in the mirror, and she was on a brace that came through from the other side. And so when the, you know, I mean, it's all in cuts. I mean, if you watch it, and the fingers come through, and she goes up, and she loved it. She called it an e-ticket ride. She said, "Oh, I want to do that again. Can we do another take? I love that." She just loved riding up and down on the on the mirror. And it was incredibly safe. You know, the one thing I'll say with, you know, between Vice Squad and Wanted Dead or Alive and some of the other big action stuff that I've done and the practical effects I've done, I have never, knocking on wood, had anybody hurt on my set. I safety things to the point of obsessiveness. And when Heather rode up and down on that mirror, it was safety to the hilt. And
that's all that pre-production right there.
It's all pre-production. We knew exactly what we were going to do.
Yeah.
Nothing changed. I mean, my script for Poltergeist 3 was like two telephone books, because everything was storyboarded. Everything had the, you know, and nobody really understood what we were doing, especially the mirror shots and things. So I had everything drawn out and laid out, overheads and storyboards. And we would have a little production meeting before each shot, so that everybody would understand what we were doing.
Interesting. Now, we've talked about your effects guys you worked with, some very notable ones. What we haven't talked about is your DPs. And being such a visual director, I have to think that your relationship with your cinematographers is a pretty close one.
When I start a film, I have a double wedding. I marry my DP and my editor, and then other people get to be concubines in the thing, like the production designer and the costume designer and the makeup people. I mean, all of these people are quite important, but my relationship with my DP, I mean, I had Alex Thompson on Deathline, multi Oscar nominated DP, who I had done a million commercials with Alex. You know, in between features, Alex used to shoot my commercials because I paid him per day what he got per week on a feature. So most of the, especially in England, most of the feature people do commercials because they make a lot of money doing it. And Alex and I had shot some amazing commercials together. And I had also shot commercials with John Alcott. And Johnny and I became great friends. With Deathline, I just thought Alex Thompson was the perfect choice to do Deathline. And it's so funny, you know, I'm like 5'9", 5'8", 5'9", and Alex is like 6'7", was, may he rest in peace. And so our perspectives of looking at setups were so different. And so he just had to get used to shooting as a short person, because I kind of keep my eye line at my eye level. So, and so anyways, I was really lucky to have Alex Thompson as my DP on my first feature. I mean, you know, he's such a genius and such an artist. And the, one of the nicest human beings. I like to surround myself with nice human beings. I my crews are my family when I'm making a movie. And when you get to choose your family instead of being assigned your family, it's really nice. So,
what are your tools that you use to communicate with your DP to have shared eyeballs?
Well, it used to be magazines. I mean, nowadays you go online and look at stuff, but
So you make a lookbook?
In a way, we didn't call it a lookbook then, but Alex and I spent hours looking at magazine clippings and photos, and my relationship with my DPs is very tight, and we work very closely. I do the setups, but I depend on my DPs to give me to paint light on the object and make it look beautiful. I will not settle for photography that's not exquisite.
Now we've come to the part of the show, Andrew's five big questions. Okay. Listeners know that no matter how you've spun these softball questions, the answers to these questions, answered right off the top of your head, will lay bare your soul and let the audience know, hey, do we dig into Gary Sherman's fascinating oeuvre, or do we watch that shiny new director du jour instead? So no pressure.
Okay, I'm ready.
Question number one, what is your most treasured possession?
My dog.
Who's named?
Bella. And she's a Labradoodle.
All right.
And yes, she's, aside from my wife, she's the love of my life and my daughter. But you said possession, and I think a dog is a possession. Other people are in possessions.
So hard to possess them. That's true. Okay, question number two. If you could be anywhere in the world right now, and I'll even give you any time in history, where and when would you be?
Well, that's a strange question. It's on a lot of levels. I've always wanted to be a director back in the 1930s, as opposed to a director. But that's not a location. Yeah, it would have been. I mean, Hollywood's not some place that I would choose to be, but I would have chose to be in Hollywood, in the, you know, when Orson Welles was making Citizen Kane. But as far as the location, I think the place I love the most in the whole world is Aberystwyth, Wales.
Really?
I love it there. I've lectured there a few times at the university, and I just, it wraps itself around me when I'm there. I love the people. I've been to the film festival there several times, you know, the Abattoir Festival, and I've lectured at the university. And I just feel at home. I don't know what it is. It's like maybe I lived there in a former life, but I just feel at home.
All right. Question number three. What movie character in all of cinema do you most identify with?
Roy Scheider and all that jazz. And Bob Fosse. I would love to be Bob Fosse. He's absolutely one of my idols. I just think he was amazing. I don't drink. I used to. But I don't drink and I don't do drugs. And I used to do that too. But that whole idea of showtime is my life.
Are there any other movie directors that you identify with that you're like, that's part of your path right there?
Yeah. You mean as far as their filmmaking?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to get into their life. I mean, I mentioned it before. Roman Polanski. I mean, I just think he's unbelievable. Hitchcock, I think, was unbelievable in most of his films and in some of his films. I don't like all of Hitchcock's films, but there's some that I just truly love. And Bob Fosse, I think, was an amazing film director. I mean, All That Jazz is one of my all-time favorite films. Lenny was amazing. But I think if I had to narrow it down to one, it's... I would have liked to have been behind the camera being Roman Polanski doing Rosemary's Baby.
It's a hell of a film.
And I would still like to make Rosemary's Baby, not Rosemary's Baby itself, but I would like to do a film in the style of Rosemary's Baby.
How would you typify that style?
Well, it's totally emotional. I mean, the underpinnings of the mythology were there, and you can accept them or not accept them, but it's the fear generated by the relationship between John Cassavetes character and why is her name going away?
Mia Farrow,
yeah. The relationship and the fear generated by the relationship between John Cassavetes and Mia Farrow was just amazing. And then the comedy generated from Ruth Gordon.
Yeah.
Was just genius.
Yeah.
It was genius. And, you know, I watch that film all the time and it has not aged a bit.
Yeah.
It is ageless. It is wonderfully ageless. So, ba-boom.
All right.
And then, you know, as far as younger directors go, I mean, currently my favorite director is Edgar.
Sure.
Edgar Wright. That's how I met him, was by writing him a note saying how much I loved one of his films, and he wrote me back. I sent him an email. Someone gave me his email, and I sent him an email and say how much I loved his film. I think it was Baby Driver, and I get a note back immediately, and he says, "Is this Deathline Gary Sherman?" And I wrote him back. I said, "Yep," and he says, "I love all your movies. I have loved all your movies since I was a little kid." And da 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 da. And he said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Chicago." He said, "Well, I'm in LA right now." He said, "When are you going to be in LA?" I said, well, actually, I'm going to be there next week. And he said, let's have dinner. And we had dinner and we just became friends. And I just love his work.
Yeah.
And actually, I think my favorite movie at the moment is the Sparks Brothers movie. I just saw it two days ago. And that'll remain my favorite movie until I see Last Night in Soho.
He really reinvented just like the series of shots. Like I remember when I was looking at Shaun of the Dead and he would do a series of shots like gearing up for something. And I was like, this existed before him, you know, caper films, whatever. But why does this feel so new?
Everything he does. Have you seen the Sparks Brothers movie?
Not yet.
He reinvented documentaries. He absolutely has reinvented the documentary. Shaun of the Dead reinvented. Baby Driver is the fucking best music video that's ever been made.
Yes.
I mean, it just is. And he and I have a wonderful mutual respect for each other. And, we have a little secret about Last Night in Soho. I can't tell you the secret. I'll just tell you that one day it'll be revealed.
We're just stacking up reasons why I want to interview you again later on. New projects, secret projects. All right, question 4. What word or phrase drives you nuts?
We can't do that. There's nothing that can't be done.
Understand?
Or the other one that drives me crazy is we'll have to live with it. Because you don't, there's always a better way to do something. And there's always a better way to do something within the parameters of what you have to do. When I hear young filmmakers say, oh, I didn't have the budget. Then I have a stock answer to that. Then you shouldn't have tried to shoot it.
Yeah.
You should have modified it to where you could afford to do it.
Right.
Because you can't put a super on the film that says, sorry, I didn't have the budget.
Yeah.
And it makes me crazy because I spend a lot of time talking to young filmmakers. I go to a lot of film festivals. I lecture at schools. And there's just too many things that are used as excuses. It shouldn't be. You're either a filmmaker or you're not a filmmaker.
Well, that's a fact. That's a fact. Okay, last one. Question 5. And longtime listeners know question 5, double jeopardy. Here we go. Celluloid or digital?
I've always been a technocrat. I love technology. I did one of the first CGI effects that was ever done on television in Mysterious 2. I did the first television movie that was shot digitally and edited digitally.
Which one was that?
After the Shock, which we shot on Sony digital cameras and we edited on a CMX. Was it the CMX 4000 or something 1000, which used video discs as the source, and you sat at a computer and you edited. And if you did a cut that was less than 12 frames, it used to break down. And it was just random accessing video. And we cut that film on that. I had a reason for doing it. I wanted it to look like a newsreel.
Yeah.
It was about the earthquake in San Francisco. And I wanted it to look, because I wanted to mix newsreel footage in with the dramatic footage and make it seamless. the only way I could do that, because most everybody was shooting digital for newsreel by that point. But nobody had ever done a television movie that was digital. And I love digital. I have a lot of fun with it, but celluloid obviously has a very deep seated in my heart. I own a print of Deathline, which is Technicolor. It's a dye transfer print. It looks as good today as it did in 1972. It was the answer print. It was the first answer print struck off a three-stripe Technicolor master. And it is absolutely pristine and beautiful. And I keep it in a temperature-controlled room. And I've showed it probably a dozen times over the years in places. And people just are blown away by it. You know, unfortunately, most print stock, especially during the 80s, the prints looked like crap.
Yeah.
And it was funny, just before the pandemic hit, Edgar knew that I had the print and talked to Quentin Tarantino, and we were going to run it at the New Beverly, and it was all scheduled to happen, and the pandemic hit, and we haven't talked about it post-pandemic. It will probably happen sometime.
Wow.
I will tuck the print under my arm. Huge goddamn print. and fly to LA and run it at the New Beverly. So it's quite beautiful. Of course, the DCP that Bill Lustig and Blue Underground created, which is, you know, off of the original negative, is so pristine. And I have run, you know, hosted screenings all over the place running that. And it's just as beautiful, if not even more beautiful. And the new Dead and Buried DCP. Well, Dead and Buried, there's not a decent print in existence. So you really can't see Dead and Buried on film the way that it originally looked. The film stock that Kodak was using back in the early 80s has not survived. It's all pink. And they look awful. So, I mean, the thing is that digital will archive for us better than film. Unless, you know, unfortunately, we moved away from Technicolor because it was too expensive. And that's a shame, because Technicolor prints are forever.
Yeah.
Technicolor prints are better at archiving than even digital. But
who pays, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a toughie.
People think of film as being ephemeral, and it shouldn't be. It is really an art form.
I think the chewed over prints that we were seeing back in the 80s in the multiplexes, that's what some people think about with, you know, celluloid versus digital. But when you go back to the archival prints, like what you're talking about, that's just a whole nother beast.
Yeah, well, there's not a decent print of Dead and Buried. There's not a decent print of Vice Squad anywhere.
Wow.
Because when the print stocks were, you know, they were just awful. The print stocks lasted a couple of years and then start to lose their color.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. And if it wasn't for the fact that we're digitally scanning the stuff for Blu-rays now, that you wouldn't have a good print of any of that.
I want to thank you, Gary, that you just have a wealth of information here. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Enjoy.
That was part 3 of my interview with writer-director Gary Sherman. Subscribe to This Bloody Business and join me each week as we go behind the scenes for more tantalizing tales of horror filmmaking. Until next time, I'm Andrew Johnson Schmidt, and that's a wrap.